Welcome back, listeners. You know, we love to get into the weeds here on The Deep Dive, and today's going to be a real deep dive into a landmark case in labor law.
Absolutely. This is one of those cases that really set the stage for so much of how we think about worker rights and employer rights, even today, almost a century later.
We're talking about NLRB v. Fansteel Metallurgical Corporation, a 1939 Supreme Court decision that's still cited and debated in labor law courses and courtrooms across the country.
And for good reason. This case gets right at the heart of a fundamental tension that always exists in labor relations. How do you balance the rights of workers to organize and fight for better conditions with the rights of employers to protect their property and manage their businesses?
And that's exactly what we're going to untangle today.
Yeah, we're going to look at a specific type of strike tactic, a sit-down strike, which is different from your typical picket line, and we'll examine how the company reacted, what the National Labor Relations Board had to say about it, and then, of course, the big kahuna, the Supreme Court's ruling, and what it means for labor law going forward.
Exactly. We're going to get into the specifics of what happened at Fansteel, how the legal arguments played out, and what lasting impact this case has had on the way we think about protected activity during labor disputes.
Right, because one of the big questions this case helped answer is, when do actions taken by workers during a labor dispute cross a line that causes them to lose the protections of the NLRA? It's a crucial question that's relevant to any student of labor law.
So let's take a trip back in time to 1936 to a company called Fansteel Metallurgical Corporation. What was the situation there? Why did this particular company end up at the center of such a landmark case?
Well, like a lot of companies in the 1930s, Fansteel was facing a wave of union organizing. A group of their employees were trying to form a union, Lodge 66, which was associated with a bigger union called the Amalgamated Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers.
Okay, so pretty standard union organizing efforts, right? But I understand Fansteel wasn't exactly thrilled about this.
You got it. They were not rolling out the red carpet for the union, to put it mildly. In fact, they hired a labor spy, someone to basically infiltrate the union and report back on what the workers were planning.
Wow, a labor spy.
Mm.
That's some serious old school union busting tactics right there. You can only imagine how that kind of move would ramp up the tension and distrust between the companies and the workers trying to organize.
Oh, absolutely. It sets a really adversarial tone right from the get-go. And it didn't stop there. In September of 36, the union tried to sit down with Fansteel superintendent and start negotiating, you know, basic stuff like wages and working conditions.
Sounds reasonable enough, right?
Oh.
Workers want to have a voice in their workplace, try to bargain for better conditions. Pretty standard stuff.
Yeah, but Fansteel wasn't having it. They just flat out refused to even talk to the union representatives.
Really? They wouldn't even meet with them?
Nope. And this wasn't a one-time thing either. By February of the next year, 1937, the majority of Fansteel's workers had signed up to join the union.
So clearly, there was strong support for the union among the workforce, but the company was still digging in its heels.
Exactly. And this brings us to a pivotal moment. February 17th, 1937, once again, the union, now representing the majority of the workforce, asked Fansteel to come to the bargaining table. And once again, Fansteel refused. They were completely unwilling to recognize or negotiate with the union.
So at this point, the workers must have felt like they were hitting a brick wall. They'd tried to organize, they'd tried to negotiate, they had majority support, but the company just wouldn't budge. So what did they do?
They decided to take more drastic action, something that would definitely get the company's attention.
Oh, I think I know where this is going. This is where the sit-down strike comes in, right?
You got it. Instead of just walking off the job and picketing outside, the workers decided to occupy the factory. They literally sat down inside two of Fansteel's buildings, basically taking control of the company's property.
Wow, that's a pretty bold move. A sit-down strike. It's a lot more confrontational than a traditional strike.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge escalation, and it definitely sends a message that the workers are serious.
And I'm sure Fansteel had something to say about this little takeover of their property.
You bet. They went straight to court and got an injunction ordering the workers to leave the buildings.
Makes sense. You can't just have people occupying your property without some kind of legal recourse.
Right. But here's the thing. The workers refused to leave. They defied the court order and continued to occupy the buildings.
So now we've got a real standoff. Workers defying a court order, the company trying to regain control of its property. What happened next?
Well, on February 26th, just a little over a week after the sit-down strike began, things came to a head. Law enforcement came in and forcibly removed the workers from the buildings.
And I'm guessing there were arrests.
Oh, yeah. A bunch of the workers were arrested. And then Fansteel did something that really set the stage for the legal battle that followed.
What did they do?
They fired all the workers who had participated in the sit-down strike, every single one of them, and they refused to rehire them.
So this wasn't just a temporary suspension or anything like that. These workers were out of a job.
That's right. And that's when the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, stepped in.
Now, the NLRB is like the referee in labor disputes, right? They're the ones who are supposed to make sure everyone's playing by the rules.
Exactly. So the NLRB looked at the situation at Fansteel and said, hang on, the company here engaged in some unfair labor practices. They were refusing to bargain in good faith with the union, which is a big no-no under the NLRA.
Makes sense. Even if the workers did something wrong by illegally occupying the buildings, the company had also broken the law by refusing to bargain.
Right. And so the NLRB said to Fansteel, you need to fix this. You need to reinstate all those workers you fired, and you need to give them back pay for the time they missed.
So the NLRB sided with the workers, saying, look, yeah, the sit-down strike was illegal, but the company was wrong first by not bargaining with the union.
That's the gist of it. But of course, Fansteel wasn't too happy with this decision.
I bet they weren't. They appealed, right?
Of course they did. And this is where things get really interesting, legally speaking. The case went up the chain of appeals. And eventually, it landed in the lap of the Supreme Court.
And this is why this case is such a big deal, because it's not just about what happened at Fansteel. It's about what the highest court in the land had to say about the balance of power between workers and employers, about the limits of what workers can do during a strike, and about the authority of the NLRB to intervene in these kinds of disputes.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court had to grapple with some really thorny questions. Did the NLRB even have the authority to order Fansteel to rehire these workers who had engaged in an illegal sit-down strike? And did Fansteel's own bad behavior, their refusal to bargain, somehow excuse or justify the workers' actions?
Those are some big questions, and they get right at the heart of the whole purpose of labor law. It's about finding a way to balance the rights of workers, to organize and bargain for better conditions, with the rights of employers to run their businesses and protect their property.
Absolutely. It's a constant balancing act, and this case really threw that tension into sharp relief.
So let's get to the big reveal. What did the Supreme Court decide in NLRB v. Fansteel?
Well, in a nutshell, the court sided with Fansteel.
Really? Even though the company had also broken the law by refusing to bargain?
Yes, even though that. The majority of the justices, led by Chief Justice Hughes, said that the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, doesn't strip employers of their right to fire workers, especially if those workers are doing something illegal.
Okay, so the right to strike isn't absolute. There are limits to what workers can do, even when they're fighting for their rights.
Precisely. And the court was very clear that the sit-down strike, the act of taking over and occupying Fansteel's property, was illegal conduct that went beyond the bounds of protected activity under the NLRA.
And that makes sense, right? I mean, you can't just go around seizing other people's property, even if you have a grievance.
Right. And the court went on to say that the NLRB's power is meant to remedy unfair labor practices committed by employers. It's not meant to punish employers or force them to rehire workers who were fired for doing something illegal.
So even if the NLRB thought that rehiring the workers would somehow make things right, the court said, no, you don't have that authority.
Right. And they were pretty emphatic about it, too. Chief Justice Hughes famously wrote that the NLRA is not meant to encourage lawlessness.
So the court was sending a clear message. Yes, workers have rights, but those rights don't give them a free pass to break the law.
Exactly. And to back up their decision, the court delved into the nitty-gritty of the NLRA itself, specifically looking at Section 10C, which lays out the NLRB's powers to remedy unfair labor practices.
Ah, so they're going into the fine print of the law to justify their decision.
Precisely. And they also looked at Section 2.3, which defines who is considered an employee under the NLRA.
Yeah, what did they find there?
Well, the law does say that people who stop working because of a labor dispute are still considered employees. But the court said that this doesn't protect workers who were fired for breaking the law, like the workers at Fansteel who took part in the illegal sit-down strike.
Okay, so Even though they were involved in a labor dispute, the fact that they broke the law meant they were no longer covered by the NLRA's protections. That's a really important distinction.
Absolutely. And the court also shut down the argument that Fansteel's refusal to bargain somehow justified or excused the workers' actions.
So no matter how badly the company was behaving, the workers still couldn't break the law and expect to be protected.
That's the bottom line.
And that's a pretty significant precedent to set.
It is. It really established a firm boundary between protected and unprotected activity during labor disputes.
But was everyone on the court in agreement? I mean, these are complex issues. There must have been some debate among the justices, right?
Oh, you know the Supreme Court, there are always different perspectives. Justice Stone, for example, wrote a concurring opinion, meaning he agreed with the outcome that Fansteel didn't have to rehire the workers, but he had a slightly different take on the legal reasoning behind it.
Okay, so same destination, different route.
Yeah, pretty much. He was particularly focused on the specific wording of Sections 2, 3, and 10C of the NLRA, the parts we were just talking about.
And what was his spin on those sections?
Well, he said that while the law does protect worker status as employees, even during a labor dispute, that protection goes away if they're fired for a legitimate reason, like destroying property or, in this case, illegally taking over the employer's property.
Makes sense. You break the law, you lose your protection.
Right. But here's where it gets interesting. Justice Stone also pointed out that not all the workers who were fired were equally involved in the sit-down strike. There were 14 workers who hadn't actually participated in the occupation of the buildings. They just supported the strike in other ways.
Ah, so he's making a distinction between different levels of involvement in the illegal activity.
Exactly. And he suggested that maybe those 14 workers who were less directly involved should still be protected under the NLRA.
That's a fascinating nuance. So even within the agreement that the company didn't have to rehire everyone, there's this idea that the level of individual involvement in the illegal activity matters.
Absolutely. And it highlights the importance of looking closely at the specific actions of each worker in these kinds of cases, not just treating everyone involved in a strike as one big homogenous group.
That makes a lot of sense. But what about the other side of the argument? Was there anyone on the court who thought the workers should have been protected, even with the sit-down strike?
Oh, yeah. There was a dissenting opinion in this case written by Justice Reed, and he was pretty adamant that the workers should have been protected.
Really? How did he justify that position?
Well, he focused on the big picture purpose of the NLRA, which, as you know, is to protect workers' rights to organize and bargain collectively. He argued that letting employers fire workers in situations like this, even when they've engaged in illegal activity, would completely undermine the whole point of the act.
So he was worried that this ruling would make workers too afraid to stand up for their rights, even when they had legitimate grievances.
Right. He was concerned about the chilling effect it would have on union organizing and collective bargaining. And he also believed that the NLRB should have more leeway to consider things like reinstatement as a way to promote industrial peace and resolve labor disputes, even when there's been some wrongdoing on the part of the workers.
So he's advocating for a more flexible approach, taking into account the broader context of the labor dispute and not just focusing on the one illegal act.
Exactly. He felt that the NLRB should be able to weigh all the factors, including the employer's role in the conflict, before making a decision.
That's an interesting perspective, and it shows that even within the Supreme Court, there were differing views on how to balance the competing interests at play in this case.
Definitely.
So at the end of the day, despite those dissenting voices, the majority ruled in favor of Fansteel.
Yes. And that decision set a pretty major precedent in labor law. It established the principle that workers who engage in illegal activity during a labor dispute, specifically the seizure and occupation of the employer's property, can be legally fired and lose the protection of the NLRA.
And that's had a lasting impact on how we think about the limits of protected strike activity.
Oh, absolutely. This case is cited all the time in labor law discussions. It really clarified that the right to strike, while important, doesn't give workers a blank check to do whatever they want.
It all comes back to that balance between worker rights and employer rights.
Exactly. And this case is a stark reminder that those rights can sometimes come into conflict. And when they do, it's up to the courts to decide how to reconcile those competing interests.
So, as we wrap up our deep dive into NLRB v. Fansteel, what are some of the key takeaways for our listeners?
Well, first and foremost, this case is a must-know for anyone studying labor law. It really gets at the core of what constitutes protected and unprotected activity during a strike, and it highlights the limits of the NLRB's authority to intervene in these kinds of disputes.
It also shows us how important it is to look at the specific facts of each case. Justice Stone's concurrence, for example, reminds us that even within a group of striking workers, there can be varying levels of involvement in illegal activity, and that can make a difference in terms of legal outcomes.
Right. And Justice Reed's dissent is a valuable reminder that there are always different perspectives on these issues and that the law isn't always black and white. Sometimes there are gray areas, and reasonable minds can differ on how to interpret the law and apply it to real-world situations.
And this case also raises some interesting questions about how this precedent might apply in today's world, with all the new and evolving forms of workplace activism.
Definitely. Think about online organizing, social media campaigns, virtual strikes, all these new tactics that workers are using to exert pressure on employers.
Does a case from 1939 really give us a clear framework for dealing with these modern forms of protest?
That's a great question, and it's one that labor lawyers and scholars are grappling with right now. How do you apply principles developed in an era of sit-down strikes and factory occupations to a world where workers can disrupt a company's operations without ever setting foot on their property?
It's definitely something to think about. The world of work has changed dramatically since 1939, but the fundamental questions about the balance of power between workers and employers are still very much alive.
Absolutely. And cases like NLRB v. Fansteel, while they might seem like ancient history, are actually still very relevant in helping us understand those fundamental tensions.
Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into a truly landmark case in labor law. We hope you found it informative and thought-provoking.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And to our listeners, keep those brains engaged and those questions coming. We'll be back soon with another deep dive into the fascinating world of law.